Zone Broadcast Center. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Dankman in for Larry Mantle. The nation's second largest school district is back in session today. It's the first day of school for Los Angeles Unified School District, and we want to hear from parents. How did you find the right school for your kid? What factors did you consider? Location, diversity, special academic programs? Join the conversation online, hit us up on social media, or on air coming up after the news. Welcome to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Libby Dankman in for Larry Mantle another day. Larry's still feeling under the weather, so we're just going to let him take one more day to recover. And I'm happy to be with you here right on Air Talk as we focus on the first day of school for LAUSD students. I know a lot of parents have just dropped their kids off or gotten them on the bus, and maybe it's sort of that big breath of, hey, the summer's over and now it's time to focus on the school year ahead. If you are a parent of an LAUSD student and you would like to share how you chose the school that your kid would be going to, that your child will be attending this year, was it a process of looking at academics, at demographics, at geography? What were the factors that went into your choice of where your child would attend school? Please give us a call at 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. You can also weigh in on the AirTalk page on KPCC.org. You can go on social media. We're available all over the place. Right now, we have some guests on the line and in studio to talk about the issue of how parents can choose an institution and also some of the changes that have been going on with LAUSD over the past year or so. In studio with me is Tanika Orange, Director of the Institute of Cultural Sustainability and Educational Equity and Assistant Director of the Principal Leadership Institute at UCLA. And she's a former LAUSD teacher and administrator and a current LAUSD parent. Hi, Tanika. Thanks for being on Air Talk.
Hi, Libby. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's so good to have you here because you actually just had a couple of your daughters who are starting high school, right? Can you tell me a little bit about that experience of getting them off to their first day of high school?
It was extremely exciting. It's like a new chapter in their life. They were nervous, anxious, and excited at the same time. And like anything, you're getting ready to start something new. They were ready to meet new friends. They were worried about, am I going to have anyone to sit with at lunch? And for me, I was worried about the same thing. Are they going to have someone to sit with at lunch besides just themselves? Are they going to enjoy their classes and all of that? So it was so exciting. My husband was excited. We were all happy for them. New chapter in their life. It's a good thing.
It's a new chapter. And I'm a twin. Your daughters are twins.
That's
so
right.
There's a whole new set of challenges, too, of when you choose classes, do you want to be in the same classes? Mm-hmm. Did they have a lot of the same interests? Did you end up thinking about it that way? Or,
you know, I wanted them to be in the same classes. I thought it would actually be a little easier for them when they would come home because they could have each other to work on their homework together. But, you know, they're older now. And so they've decided on their own that they would like to have some classes together and some classes apart. And so we honored that and they're happy. They only have two classes together and they do get to have lunch together. So that's a good thing.
That's wonderful.
Yes.
My sister and I ended up being so different. We're fraternal twins. I know your daughters are identical twins. And we went to, you know, separate ends of the school in many ways. We played sports together, but oftentimes it was all about, you know, carving out our own identity. So
right.
That was a big part of the selection process. Also with us to talk about how parents can choose a school and the changes that have been going on in LAUSD over the past year, David Tikofsky is a consultant strategist with the Associated Administrators of Los Angeles, which represents principals and other administrators working in LAUSD, and a former LAUSD board member and a former teacher in the district. David, thanks very much for joining Air Talk today.
Wonderful for you to highlight the beginning of school.
Yes. So we got the backpacks on, peachy folders, pens and pencils, everything. Everybody's all set. Maybe a new t-shirt or a new pair of shoes as the kiddos go off to their first day. What, because of all this tumult that's been happening in LAUSD over the past year, what do you expect to be different for students in the Los Angeles Unified School District?
Well, we can only dream that the year will go focused on curriculum and instruction and kids' excitement and teachers' commitment and energy. But we know in an urban setting like L.A. County, lawsuits and strikes and politics and election year can distract the best intentions and turn them into mush.
That's certainly true. Best laid plans. This strike from last year, one of the agreements that was struck was the issue of class sizes. And I was looking at a really great Twitter thread by our own LAUSD reporter, Kyle Stokes, about the number of students and the grades that will see a reduction in their class sizes. It's a really nice piece of work. And there's more coverage on LAIST, LAIST.com, our website. If you want to check that out. David, when you think about the process that parents have to go through to locate what school they have their heart set on and then apply maybe for an inter-district transfer to get into that school or apply to some set of criteria to get admittance, what do parents need to know about both choosing a school and applying it and being accepted to an LAUSD school that they would really like their kids to go to?
First of all, the class size reduction is one student. So let's not get carried away.
That's definitely true. Yeah.
Anything here, because one student is about six less than the flu season. And when the flu season comes around, class size can reduce by seven. And if some teacher gives a lot of significant homework, I think class size reduces by five. So let's not get carried away with what's happening in the state of California. The governor put $2 billion of new money in, and he put it all in early education. Did not do anything like Governor Wilson, strangely, a Republican, who reduced class size K through three the most dramatically we've ever seen, and chaotically, of course, too. When it comes to choice, of course, the word choice is really the words of the Southern segregationists back to the 1960s. We shouldn't be focusing on the word choice. What we should be focusing on is opportunity, equity, and excellence. And that exists in school districts across the county. You know there's over 80 school districts in the county. You know there are private schools, there are parochial schools, Jewish day schools, charter schools. There's all kinds of schools out there. There's homeschooling, which has become increasingly popular with the autistic community in some of the valley. It's been reported on. So, yeah, there are different opportunities out there. But like I said, it would be nice to focus in on the excitement of science and discovery. The civics in an election year would be a great point of view and a subject matter. Social studies have come up in the debates about desegregation, race relations. It's a perfect topic for eighth grade U.S. history to really delve into the issues of the Civil War and the 11th grade teachers of social studies to deal with the 20th century changes in the 21st century.
So. That's a really big slate of topics, David. And, you know, just throwing it out to our parents, I'd love to hear from you again. The question is, how did you choose a school for your student in LAUSD? How did you zero in on where you'd like your kid to go? If it's a local school or a magnet school, some special program like a dual language program. But also, if you have any concerns about the start of the school year, some of the issues that David Tikofsky just brought up, please give us a call, 866-893-5722. In fact, I want to, have Stephen in Sherman Oaks join the conversation because he's calling in with his story about how they chose an LAUSD school. Hi, Stephen. Thanks for being on Air Talk.
Yeah, I just dropped off my daughter for her first day of kindergarten at the kindergarten orientation. The kindergarten teacher, one of the first things she said was, "We accept every child. We don't turn any child away." And philosophically, that is meaningful for my wife and me, perhaps more meaningful than putting her on some private school track that gets her to some particular college down the road. That's why we chose LAUSD in our local elementary school.
So it was about looking at the health of a local school district for you, the diversity that is involved with that. I mean, are those the factors when you say they accept everyone? Those are the ideas that kind of come to mind, right? Having a school that reflects more of the demographics of what Los Angeles is?
Absolutely. And keep in mind, Sherman Oaks is not always Los Angeles. But yes, that is the case, that I want my daughter to understand the full breadth and width of humanity, not just a homogenized group.
Stephen in Sherman Oaks, thanks so much. And congratulations on your daughter's starting school today. Very exciting for many parents and kids out there. In the studio with us is Tanika Orange, director of the Institute for Cultural Sustainability and Educational Equity and assistant director of the Principal Leadership Institute at UCLA. Tanika, when you were looking at how to identify a school for your daughters, your twin daughters, what were the factors you considered and what was that process like?
You know, I consider myself, I have privilege because I am an educator, so I understand the system pretty well. It's not an easy system to navigate if you do not. So trying to think through, are they going to go to their local high school? Will they go to a magnet school? Are they going to go outside of the district? My daughters have been outside of the district. They've been homeschooled, and they have gone to traditional LAUSD public schools. And so I understand how to make the decisions on what is it that I'm looking for. It is diversity. Diversity is defined many different ways. But for me, it's making sure that my daughters, when they walked into a school, that they saw folks who looked like them, that I understood that from the principal's perspective and the administrator's perspective, that it was important that who they were culturally, it was going to be sustained in that school and highlighted in that school. And I guess the most important thing was actually listening to them, because when they walked into the particular school, they're going to University High, they came out with smiles on their face. They said, "Mom, this is the school." And it was the social and emotional aspect when they walked into this space. Besides just the academics, it was how they felt, how safe, how secure, and that they already felt cared for as they walked in before school even started. That was the most important thing, because context matters. You cannot learn if you do not feel those things.
So you feel like being on site at a school is really important. I mean, I think that's a hard thing. You look at the list online of all the different offerings and magnet programs and special language things that are available. But ultimately for you, it's about visiting a school and actually feeling the culture that's on site there.
Sure. Every school says they're diverse. Every school says they're for social justice. Every school says they're a math and science or STEAM school. You really have to go and see what the feel is and understand really what's going on and how teachers are going to really support, and not just, again, academically, but it is that social and emotional support that comes first before anything else can take place and happen.
Was it stressful, the process of deciding, especially when your kids matriculated between, you know, elementary school, middle school, and now high school? The choices seem overwhelming, but also the administrative process of applying and making sure they can go where they want to go. Is that process burdensome, especially to a parent who maybe doesn't speak English as a first language or doesn't have the resources or time to kind of go through that process?
Yes, 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 yes. That, yes, it is. It is. Again, because I understand the system, I know how to navigate it. And I often used to say it's very difficult, if you do not know the system, to figure out how to decide what this magnet program is, how many options do I really get from a choices brochure that LAUSD gives you to pick your school selection. So it becomes very difficult. If I want to leave the district, how do I go about that process? And the multiple times you have to go and fight for your child to leave the district, it's a process. And it's really difficult if you don't understand the system.
You said fight. Sure, sure. And you said fight for your child. And I want to hear stories from parents who are out there who have kind of gone to bat and have really, you know, worked to make sure their kid was in the right spot. How did you decide where that spot was? What was the process like? How did you work with the district? And why did you choose that institution? Why was that important for you? What were the criteria? 866-893-5722 In studio with me is Tanika Orange with UCLA, and on the line is David Tukofsky, consultant strategist with the Associated Administrators of Los Angeles, and they represent principals and other administrators working in LAUSD. And there's some changes coming for principals this year in LAUSD. Austin Buettner is making some adjustments to the structure and trying to make principals' lives easier. So we're going to ask David about that coming up after this short break. Give us a call again. Parents, how did you choose a school in LAUSD for your child? 866-893-5722. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle, back after this break. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Libby Denkman here for Larry Mantle while he takes a day off recovering from a summer bug. David Tukofsky on the line. David Tukofsky is your name, sir. Consultant strategist with the Associated Administrators of Los Angeles, which represents principals and other administrators working in LAUSD. He's a former LAUSD board member and a former teacher in the district. And David, I wanted to get your take because I hear that Austin Buettner is really trying to make life better for principals and administrators and also decentralize the way the administration is set up in LAUSD. What do you make of those plans and how they might affect administrators and principals?
Yeah, he had a very horrible first year with a combative strike where he learned a lot of things about the energy of teachers and the community support of teachers and the big mistake of turning Measure EE, which was a good goal of raising revenue, over to the mayor to run that measure. And it was a dismal result run by the mayor and the teachers union rather than being run by the school district. So I'm hoping he doesn't get overjoyed with doing structural changes and just allows teachers, parents and administrators to focus on children and not start doing this. You know, we're no longer the Soviet Union. We're going to decentralize. The emphasis on structure rather than curriculum has always been another loss of a year. We need resources and we need calm for teachers to do what they do, get the resources so that they don't have to fight for crayons and Kleenex and field trips, and get other institutions to care about public education, that the MTA becomes a place where people read on the buses and the trains like they do in most countries, and the city and the county help with the nurses and issues of safety and social workers. It's really an all-hands-on-deck community effort when you talk about children and the future. So I'm not hoping that he'll do too much overt or covert structural change and let people do what they've been trained to do for the first time, have a year of calm.
And you mentioned the parcel tax, EE failing. What was the big, who dropped the ball there? You're saying the mayor failed to get this over the finish line, but it was also held during a special election. I mean, a low turnout time for Los Angeles voters. But it does mean that the district is going to be looking for $500 million, maybe in a future election, maybe another ballot measure, sending it again to Los Angeles voters. What happened with EE?
Oh, you hit it right on the nose. The decision by the then board president and vice president and the superintendent to put it on a special election with low turnout, with a city council race in the most conservative council district in L.A., was not very thoughtful, but it was juiced by the strike, this feeling that, oh, boy, look at that energy we had, that we can land on Mars tomorrow. Board member Schmerlson and McKenna wanted to do it on the previous November where there was greater turnout. We have two elections coming up in 2020, March and November, which will be high turnout of people in L.A. County and L.A. Unified. But there isn't much talk right now about a March election, so it looks like things will have to be on that big November presidential, and we hope we can get that kind of revenue there from the voters locally, from the state, instead of putting all the stuff in a rainy day fund. We're kind of having a drought in terms of public education. Let's get some of that rainy day fund to our classrooms pre-K to 12. And finally, who dropped the ball? They raised over $10 million, and there were only $2 million against it. And so the money was there. But the real problem, I think, was a poorly executed whole strategy on a short timeline on a low turnout with no clear difference of what this money would do.
Mm. David Tikofsky, you just heard him kind of diagnosing the failure of Measure EE. The parcel tax that went down to defeat would have raised $500 million for LAUSD. Tanika Orange also with us right now. We are talking about how you can choose a school for your student. Why did you decide to send your LAUSD student to a certain school, whether in your neighborhood or elsewhere? And parents are calling in 866-893-5722 because it's the first day of LAUSD. Amy in Rancho Park. Hi, Amy. How did you choose a school for your child or your children?
We have one child. Thank you for having me on. And we sent our daughter to the neighborhood school, a block and a half from our house. We bought our house to go to that school, and we went to Overland Elementary for K through five, and we loved it. And we applied for magnet points each year to store them up for when it was time to go to middle school. Our neighborhood school is Palms Middle School, and when we toured it, we thought that it was maybe not the right fit for our daughter, who is now 12. So we applied to go to Paul Revere Middle School, which is in the Palisades. That school is a feeder to Pali High, which we found to be very desirable. And so we are now in our second year at Paul Revere. We applied our magnet points, put her into the magnet. She did it for a year, and it was great, but we really wanted to try the charter. So we've now given up our magnet points. For them all. We earned magnet points for being in the magnet last year, and now we've given them up. But we joined the charter at Paul Revere, and we think it's terrific. And there is no magnet at Pali High, so, you know, hopefully it'll be great that she's in the charter for 7th and 8th, and then go on to high school.
And are you confident that this will be able to feed into the high school that your daughter is hoping for, just the same as the magnet would have?
Yeah, the real selling point when you take a tour of Paul Revere that it feeds into Pali High, which is a great high school. They have so many good programs. So my husband and I were confident in the system and hope that Paul Revere turns to be great.
Amy in Rancho Park, sounds like you are very strategic and very on top of things. So I think your daughter has a great future ahead for getting in wherever she's hoping to go. And I thank you for calling in and sharing your story. 866-893-5722 to talk about why you chose a certain LAUSD school for your child and what the factors were that went into that decision. Tanika Orange with us from UCLA. When you hear that, you hear a parent who had to really strategize far in advance. I mean, storing up the magnet points, everything like that. It's a real process.
It's a process. And this just reminds me of just something David said earlier, which is that it's really not a choice. The whole, you know, the goal would be that you have an opportunity to, at no matter what school you go to have an academic experience and a experience socially that is just exceptional for all students. But the fact that you have to store magnet points and to move to a different school, you lose your magnet points. It becomes a level of competition on who gets into which school, which pits schools against one another. I mean, there are good things in all schools and there are things that need to be changed and shifted in schools. And so that in itself is very difficult for folks to end up navigating. Like, how many magnet points should I get? Is this school then better than other schools? It becomes this competition that is just unnecessary and it makes it very difficult to navigate for folks.
There's this whole language. I mean, I didn't know what magnet points were before I started looking into, you know, what parents are facing, not having a child in the district or, you know, a child in school right now. We're talking about the choice that parents have, or maybe it's not so much of a choice of where to send your students. 866-893-5722. David Tikofsky, when you hear this parent who's had to really strategize, save up points, then give up points, what's the solution for somebody who, you know, really has a lot of issues navigating such a complicated system?
Well, first, I want to remind the listening audience that magnet schools are desegregation schools. They come out of the era of busing that our U.S. senator brought to the fore recently. So magnets are not about choice. They're about desegregation. That is to say, Paul Revere is a place where many zip codes come together. There used to be a magnet, in fact, at Pali High. It went away as the school changed in its form to an independent charter. But I think the parents should just remain calm and invest their love and intelligence in their child and not do like Miss Orange or myself, put our kids through four or five different kinds of schools. Mine went to magnets, to charters, to private, to public. Unless you want your kid to become a cultural anthropologist studying schools in the future, just invest in them. Make sure they're excited about their day, as it was presented earlier in the show, that the energy of the teacher is invested in the kid, that the administration, the bus drivers, the facilities folks, today is a day where everybody has a high energy for their altruistic and committed to kids feeling. And if we can keep that steady during the year rather than panicking and politicking and having somebody sue over the distribution of revenue when the pizza is only a medium size and we need to get an extra large pizza of funding for the kids in L.A. County schools and schools of poverty in particular, and diversity, which does require a greater investment than a state like Utah, where the students might be a larger class size, but the homogeneity is much greater. So,
David, we're running out of time for this segment. David Tikofsky, consultant strategist with the Associated Administrators of Los Angeles and a former LAUSD board member, former teacher in the district. It is the first day of school for LAUSD. We're talking about how parents chose the school that they're going to and why. Just a brief thought from Tanika Orange, who's in studio with me. She is with UCLA, also a former LAUSD teacher and administrator. When you think about the first day of school as a former teacher, what's the biggest thing that comes to mind, the most important thing for a teacher and a student and for future success of that student when you think about the first day?
I think the most important thing for me as a teacher and as an administrator, it was to make sure we started to build trust with students and that it was reciprocal trust, that they, you know, that we created an atmosphere that they felt well cared for. And that line, if you start that right at the beginning and you continuously and you continue and you're intentional about it throughout the entire school year, that is the most important thing. And that is the exciting thing about the new start of school. You get to think about how am I going to build these relationships and how am I going to carry that through the entire year.
Tanika Orange with UCLA, Director of the Institute for Cultural Sustainability and Educational Equity. Thanks again to my other guests, David Tikofsky, Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. Happy first day of school to all the LAUSD students out there and other districts who are starting today. Coming up, we're going to talk about a groundbreaking new project from the New York Times. It's called the 1619 Project. You may have seen it on your newsstands over the weekend. It's about centering the history of slavery in the U.S. when we think about the foundations of American society and government and so much more. It's a great project, and we have the lead reporter who conceived of this project coming up next after this news break with Hedy Lynn Hurtis. A new project by the New York Times posits this idea. The year 1619 was just as important, if not more, to the founding of our country as 1776. That's because 400 years ago, the first African slaves arrived on the shores near the Jamestown colony. They were some of the 12 and a half million people who were kidnapped from their homeland, brought across the Atlantic Ocean to an unfamiliar place far from family, who they would never see again. When these men, women, and children ended up here, what would eventually become the United States, they were forcibly enslaved to build wealth for white people and lay the foundations of this country. The slave trade remains one of the largest forced migrations in human history. And to mark the anniversary of the start of American slavery and to recognize its foundational role in American life, the New York Times just launched the 1619 Project. And it's the brainchild of Nicole Hannah Jones, a reporter for the New York Times Magazine, who focuses on racial injustice. And she was the lead reporter for the 1619 Project. Nicole, it's great to have you on. I've been reading your work and I've been reading some of the project, and it's an amazing endeavor. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
So the beginning of your piece, you write about your father. You write about him raising the American flag, and he was proud to raise it outside your house. But you talk about the way you felt as a young person, that in fact, that flag was a sign that your father had internalized degradation and internalized racism. Why did you feel that way, and how did your thoughts evolve?
I was very ambivalent about the country of my citizenship when I was a teenager. I had just begun to study African-American history. I saw how hard people in my family worked and never seemed to get ahead. And it just seemed to me that we had never, we as in Black Americans, had never been treated as full citizens in our country. And so I didn't understand why he would so outwardly display a patriotism towards a country that did not treat us as citizens.
And so as you were watching this and feeling this sense of that your father had an internalized racism or internalized the way that America had treated Black people, what eventually made you see it from another angle? And what was that angle?
Well, it's funny because I didn't really start to understand or change my thinking on it until very, very recently. And it was really when I was thinking about this project and I began to research the project and really spend a lot of time in texts that were examining Black Americans' roles as kind of the vanguard of our democracy. And it was in that I just began to think very differently about who has a right to claim this country as our own, and that even though Black people, you know, from really the beginning, since we first were brought to this land, the Supreme Court affirmed it in Dred Scott, this sense that we could not be citizens of the land of our birth, that it was actually deeply offensive to everything that our ancestors had gone through and to the really indelible contributions that Black Americans had made both to making the ideals of our founding documents true and also just to the freedom struggles in this country in general. Not to claim this legacy as our own, not to claim this country as our own. But that shift is very, very recent. And I really finally understood that when my dad flew that flag, my dad was a military veteran. Like many Black men, you know, Black people are overrepresented in the military. We're the most likely to join the military. And that's always been tied to our desire to be treated as full citizens, believing if you fought for your country, maybe your country would finally treat you as an American, that he was flying that flag because he believed he had a right to claim that flag and a right to claim the land that our ancestors fought for. And I've come to agree with him.
And that sentiment that your dad understood and that you came to agree with, that really underpins the 1619 Project. You said that you were researching that when you had this sort of revelation about his raising the flag. How did this project come to be, and how did you pitch it?
So I've been obsessed with the year 1619 really since I was in high school. And I first came across that date as a high school student when I was reading a book by Lerone Bennett called Before the Mayflower. And I just remember almost this feeling of being struck by lightning, of never having seen that date, never having been taught that date, never having been taught that people of African descent were brought here and sold into slavery before the Pilgrims even landed at Plymouth Rock, and really understanding at that moment that there was a reason we are not taught that, that this was an attempt to obscure the centrality of slavery. So I've thought about this date for a really long time, and as the anniversary was approaching, I just kept thinking that this is the 400th year of a foundational institution to the United States, and most Americans don't even know that they're the anniversary approaching. Most Americans don't know the year 1619, and I wanted to try to use the tremendous platform of the New York Times to change that, to force this country to confront the legacy of what I consider to be a foundational institution to America, and to really mark our founding at 1619 and not 1776, to argue that our decision to purchase that first group of human beings in the Virginia colony would impact nearly everything about this country that would come after.
That's Nicole Hannah-Jones, reporter for the New York Times Magazine, who focuses on racial injustice. And she led the 1619 Project, which you can find on the New York Times website. Nicole, a lot of the printed copies really went very fast on the newsstands over the weekend. I know folks who subscribe obviously got them delivered to homes. I understand you also distributed hundreds of thousands more copies than would normally be printed. Is that right? What's the demand been like to read this work that you and other writers have accomplished in the New York Times Magazine?
It's been a bit insane. I absolutely could not have predicted the thirst for this excavation that we were attempting to do and this reframing of the American narrative. All across the country, the newspaper sold out on newsstands. People were driving from location to location to location, trying to get their hands on it. We've just now today announced that we are selling copies of the project online. And I just didn't expect the demand to be that way. We fundraised in order to print 200,000 additional copies, because I personally believed it was very important that not just the Times subscribers or the typical Times reader who tends to be white and affluent get access to this project, that it was very important for the communities who are most affected by the legacy of slavery to get access to this project as well. And so we have been distributing these copies for free in schools and in communities across the country.
I know one of my fellow reporters here, my colleague Emily Elena Dugdale, who's African-American, is very excited about having secured a paper version. And she said she's going to, you know, keep it for posterity and keep it like it's a first edition of, a very valuable comic book or something that is going to be part of her life, because she finds that it's so important to, have that. And that's the kind of, reach that the paper version is having, even beyond what a normal subscription for The New York Times has had. So it definitely is being seen across the country. Nicole Hannah-Jones is a reporter for The New York Times Magazine, focusing on racial injustice. Her piece as part of the 1619 Project is called "Our Democracy's Founding Ideals Were False When They Were Written. Black Americans Have Fought to Make Them True." And we want to go more into that, and also the reason that a lot of Americans didn't know the year 1619 before this groundbreaking project was published over the weekend. On the line with us as well is Stephanie Rogers-Jones, Associate Professor of History at UC Berkeley. It's Jones-Rogers. Professor Jones-Rogers, what do you think the reason is that, as Nicole mentioned, this year, 1619, was so little known to the average American, as opposed to some of the more, well-celebrated years, 1776, in American history?
So first, thank you so much for having me on the show, Libby. I think our nation's amnesia about 1619 and about the institution of slavery more broadly has a lot to do with how the story of America has and really has not been told. You know, we often learn about slavery as an institution that was tangential to the founding of the nation. It was an inconvenient regime that really had nothing to do with the founders' vision of the nation and its fledgling democracy. But when you teach people that slavery was unimportant to the nation, that it was unimportant to its founding principles, its laws, its economy, its social order, why would you even want to know more about it? And so one of the wonderful things about the 1619 Project is something that I think Nicole Nicole drives home, Ms. Jones drives home in her piece. And she argues that, you know, by Black Americans simply existing served as a problematic reminder of this nation's failings, and that for 400 years, Black people have been seen as a problem. So who wants to study a problem? You know, who wants to be more versed and more knowledgeable about the experiences of a whole entire group of individuals who are deemed a problem to the nation? So I think that has a lot to do with why 1619 is not known, is rarely known by the average American, and that the fundamental date is fundamental in large part because at that same moment in Virginia, the development of one of the very first kind of colonial legislatures was meeting and convening and discussing a fledgling democracy in that very moment in those very same months. So I think it's really critical, and it's such an important project. And so I think that's really what's going on here.
Stephanie Jones Rogers, Associate Professor of History at UC Berkeley. We also are speaking with Nicole Hannah-Jones, reporter for the New York Times Magazine, who conceived of and is the lead reporter on the 1619 Project, which reframes the year that African slavery began in the United States, or what would become the United States, as really foundational to who we are as a country and to what we became as Americans. The 1619 Project, you can find it on the New York Times website. We're going to be back after this very short break with Nicole and Stephanie. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. Back after this. Welcome back to Air Talk. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. We just left with a thought about the 1619 Project and about why the institution of slavery and the suppression of Black Americans' full citizenship and rights as Americans for so long hasn't received as much attention as a lot of other aspects of American history. And Stephanie E. Jones Rogers of UC Berkeley was positing that, you know, a lot of this has to do with it's an inconvenient truth about American history that makes us not as maybe proud of what, you know, underpins this entire enterprise that we call America. And Nicole Hannah-Jones, you have a part of your piece in the New York Times Magazine in the 1619 Project that really resonated with me and kind of follows that idea from Stephanie Jones Rogers. And it is, I'm going to quote here, "Free Black people," and this is during the Jim Crow era, "posed a danger to the country's idea of itself as exceptional, and we held up the mirror in which the nation preferred not to peer." Do you think that that's still true, Nicole Hannah-Jones, that the nation just prefers not to look too deeply because it challenges who we think we are as Americans?
Absolutely. I mean, the point of the piece is not just to describe where we were, but to describe where we are. And when you think about our creation myth, about the national memory we have about who we are, it is that we were this exceptional nation, this nation founded on individual rights, on equality, that all men are created equal. And then at that same time, you know, I write in there, while Thomas Jefferson is writing some of the most famous words in the English language, his enslaved brother-in-law is there with him to make sure that he's comfortable. And he is one of 130 people that Thomas Jefferson owns at that time. The first 10 of our 12 presidents were enslavers. This is our founding paradox, and it gives lie to this notion that we were an exceptional country. It gives lie to this notion that we believed in equality of men when one-fifth of the population would have no rights. They were in absolute bondage. We're the only people who were forced to come here. So every time we see Black Americans, the 40 million descendants, it is a reminder of that lie. It is a reminder of that sin. It is a reminder that we were just one of many nations built on slavery. So I think that that is why you still see inequality. You still see people who are so willing to pathologize Blackness, because if you say that we are, now it's not, people don't argue that we're racially inferior or genetically inferior. They argue that Black culture is inferior, that Black culture is pathological. So if you can continue to point to statistics and hold us as a kind of a caste apart, then you can continue to justify slavery. Then slavery doesn't feel so bad. And if you can decentralize slavery from our national narrative, if you can pretend that it's irrelevant that those who were most powerful in this country at the time of the revolution were powerful because they got money and influence from enslaving others, then you can pretend that slavery really didn't have much to do with the development of our country. And so we have to hold on to that myth. We have to continue to marginalize Black people in order to reconcile that contradiction at our birth and that hypocrisy. And what this project is trying to do is reframe that, and also actually to argue that the people who believe the most in our founding ideals are the ones who are denied absolute freedom under that foundation.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, do you think that that's why we're seeing people getting upset about the 1619 Project, that it's a form of it's a challenge to the heroes of our history that we lionize? It's a challenge to our institutions that we hold up as being an example for the rest of the world to follow. You're by examining this in such an unflinching way, the history and the fundamentality of slavery in American life, you are challenging America from their perspective. The people who are I see on social media kind of pushing back, or Newt Gingrich going on Fox News and getting upset. Do you think that's what's at the core of that reaction?
Well, of course. I mean, the least surprising thing to me is that people are opposed to the reframing that we're doing, particularly the type of people who are opposed to it. Again, we want to believe, you know, after the Civil War, there was a whole intentional effort to downplay the role of slavery, to kind of purge the centrality of slavery from our history books and from the way that we're taught about our country, even though the contemporaries made it very clear how central slavery was. I mean, it's codified in the Constitution. So I'm not surprised that there has been this pushback. What I would say, though, is one, the pushback is not against the facts. So it's not that people are pushing back saying you got these facts wrong, what you're writing is incorrect. They're certainly pushing back against the argument. And I think that there is this almost visceral reaction that people have when you center Black Americans, when you center those who have been the bottom of caste in this country in the American narrative, the people who are not even considered capable of being citizens of this country, who are considered antithetical to our ideals of democracy. When you center them in that narrative, that makes people very uncomfortable. And my argument to that is, only if you believe that Black Americans are not fully Americans do you have a problem with this story, because it is actually a very liberating story to say that those who had the least actually believed in these ideals the most and were able in this country to work to try to bring those to realization. And that's really the argument that we're making.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, the lead reporter on the 1619 Project. We also spoke with Stephanie E. Jones-Rogers, associate professor of history at UC Berkeley. And just briefly, Nicole, we only have about a minute and a half left here. If people are going to check out some of the work in the 1619 Project on the New York Times website, where should they look? Besides your piece, obviously, it's kind of the capstone of the entire project. But what are the other creators that we should pay attention to in the other writings?
Yeah, I mean, there's pieces on why we have so much bad traffic. There's pieces on why we're the only Western industrial country not to have universal health care. There's pieces on sugar, on health disparity, on the very geography of our country. The entire thesis of the magazine is that you can take many things in modern American life that you think have nothing to do with slavery and trace them back and show that they do, and that it's not just hurting Black Americans, but that it's hurting all Americans until we grapple with this legacy.
Thank you so much, Nicole Hannah-Jones, reporter for the New York Times Magazine. Great conversation and a great project that you must go check out on their website, the 1619 Project. I'm Libby Dankman in for Larry Mantle. We're going to be back after the news break. Welcome to Air Talk. Libby Dankman here for Larry Mantle. Larry's just taken a sick day. He's feeling under the weather. And that rolls nicely into our next topic, which is about healthcare and the people who provide healthcare, especially in rural and inner city communities, and whether there are enough doctors to fill those roles. Being sick or injured is a really vulnerable time, and you want to feel confident that a trained medical professional will be there to care for you, spend the time that's needed to make sure that you heal properly. But California is facing a problem, especially in rural clinics and inner cities. There are not enough primary care doctors to keep up with demand. And the doctor shortage here is only set to get worse. That's the subject of a new story in Cal Matters. It's by Elizabeth Aguilera. She is a reporter with Cal Matters covering health and social services. Her latest piece is called Paging More Doctors, California's Worsening Physician Shortage. And she's here in studio with me. Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Libby.
So what is the role of a primary care physician in a community? Why is that so important to a community's health?
So your primary care physician, that's your first line doctor. You don't feel well, that's the person you think of calling. You find something suspicious on your skin, that's the person you think of calling. Almost anything, you know, that happens to us, I'm going to go see my doctor. That's the person we're talking about, the primary care physician. That person then, if they feel like what's going on with you is serious enough, they send you to a specialist, right? They send you to a dermatologist. They might send you to see a surgeon if they feel like that's something at that level. So those are our first care, and they're important because they know your history. You know, if you've got the same doctor, they know the different things that you've experienced. They probably know your family. They know some of the things that are going on with you. That's why those people are important to communities, especially in rural areas where there might be one physician. I went to Northern California. There was one physician for this very large area who really knows everyone in town, knows the history, and who's hanging on because there isn't a new physician coming to work behind him. So he's put off his retirement a lot. In the inner city area, it's the same thing. And you want primary care physicians to be close by. If you don't have a close by doctor, you might put off care. You might wait to see how bad you feel.
The preventative care aspect of this is really key, because if I'm feeling something, I might have a twinge, I might have, you know, a suspicion that something might get worse. If a doctor is inaccessible, if a doctor means an hour and a half drive, I'm not going to go.
No. And by the time you do decide that you are feeling so bad that you have to go somewhere, you're going to go to the hospital.
What do the numbers look like? How bad is the physician shortage, and how is it expected to progress over time?
So right now, the physician shortage is there's sort of these studies that say within 10 years, by 2030, California is going to have a really serious physician shortage. But as we mentioned, rural areas and certain inner city areas are already seeing that pinch. So we're saying the federal government says there should be 60 to 80 physicians for about every 100,000 people. In some areas, the number is much less. And so there are already areas where you're seeing that. In the Inland Empire is, I believe, in the high 30s. The San Joaquin Valley is also in the 30s. And so you're seeing areas where people are waiting longer or having to travel farther distances.
So the shortage is already really hitting those outlying areas in the inner city. And it's down the line expected to be throughout communities in California. I wanted to bring into the conversation Dr. Mark Henderson, professor of internal medicine at the UC Davis School of Medicine, where he's also the vice chair for education and associate dean for admissions. Dr. Henderson, how would you characterize the issue of physician staffing across California? Is that a problem that's been on your radar?
Yes, thanks, Libby. I definitely agree with much of what Elizabeth has said. I think that it's not only a problem of an inadequate supply of primary care physicians, but it's a maldistribution, if you will, of those physicians. So we have many more physicians per capita in the urban areas, the San Francisco Bay Area, and big shortages in the areas that Elizabeth mentioned. It's definitely something that we, as a medical school who's committed to trying to produce the kinds of physicians that California needs, it's definitely on our mind. I would add to what Elizabeth said that a single primary care physician in a community actually has been shown to improve many, many measurements of health in that community, even mortality. So the investment of putting a primary care physician in a community really pays off in terms of health of that community, mortality, and even economic benefits. It's almost like a vaccine for a community. So it's really important for us to think about how we can bolster the primary care physician workforce.
And I'd like to put a number out. If we have physicians or healthcare providers that are listening and want to weigh in on why we are seeing a doctor shortage, a problem with staffing up for primary care providers in especially rural and inner city communities, 866-893-5722. That's the number. If you're a healthcare provider and you want to weigh in on why this shortage is happening, 866-893-5722. You just heard the voice of Dr. Mark Henderson with the UC Davis School of Medicine. Elizabeth Aguilera with CalMatters wrote the piece that we're talking about right now. It's called Paging More Doctors, California's Worsening Physician Shortage. And Elizabeth, what are the theories about what's behind the shortage? Why is this happening?
So the experts I spoke to, including Mark at UC Davis, you know, talk about the fact that there are medical students are coming out of medical school with a significant amount of school loan debt, right? So when they're in school, they have to decide what their area is going to be. A lot of students, a lot of folks say they're influenced to the specialties because of the fact that they're going to owe a lot of money when they finish. And so the specialties pay more. Primary care physicians, on average, about $200,000 a year. Specialists, $250,000 up to $500,000 a year. And even more if you are a neurosurgeon or something that's very complicated and a small pool of. And so those are some of the reasons. The other idea is that even if you do go into primary care, as Mark mentioned, you're not necessarily attracted to going to the rural areas. You're not going to the inner city. Rural areas, I think one of the things in Bieber, California, which is in Lassen County where I went, they talked about having a difficulty finding doctors to take Dr. Daly's place because he is really a sole practitioner up there. He said it's bootstraps.
He lives in a log cabin.
Yes, he lives in a log cabin on down a dirt road that's 5 miles long. But he has talked about, he's in the clinic every day dealing with things like diabetes and colds and doing skin biopsies and sending those off to see if someone might have skin cancer. But he's also rounding in the hospital in the morning to see his patients who are nearby. He is doing 24-hour shift in the emergency room at the hospital nearby. He is called out to the scene of a farm accident or a car wreck. And he's stabilizing people out there in the field, getting them ready for helicopter transport. That's not something that our primary care physicians here in the city are used to doing. And so I think their challenge has been finding someone who's willing to do that. He's also delivered 1,000 babies or more. So you're doing all of those things and you're not near a big medical center. You're not near a specialty group. And that's a challenge. In the inner city, it's a little bit different. The CEO at MLK Community Hospital here in Los Angeles told me that, Medi-Cal reimbursement rates, Medi-Cal being the Medicaid program here in California for low-income Californians, they don't pay back to doctors as much as other states do. And so it's a really hard thing to make your bottom line if you set up practice there. And that's
places
one of the
challenges.
Places
that have a large number of Medi-Cal recipients. That's Elizabeth Aguilera with CalMatters. I really encourage you to read her piece in CalMatters about the doctor shortage. Dr. Daly, that she mentioned, it reminded me of a character from like Little House on the Prairie, like a frontier doctor, because he's just handling so many different types of situations. Also on the line with us, Dr. Mark Henderson with UC Davis School of Medicine. Dr. Henderson, what do you say to students who are graduating or looking at the specialty that they want to go into and they're looking at primary care physicians and how much they make, and they might be looking at anesthesiologists or dermatologists, and they see the realities of that? I mean, how do you encourage students to go into primary care, or do you, when you know the financial realities will be tougher?
Sure, Libby. I think that those are really important questions for us to be grappling with. I think the approach we've taken here at UC Davis is, honestly, we try to accept into our medical school students who have a deep connection to a community that may be underserved, for instance, a rural community or an inner city community. They tend to have a deep commitment to wanting to pay back, if you will, make a difference in their own home community or in a community, a cultural community that they identify with. If you look at U.S. medical schools across the country, medical students don't really reflect the tremendous racial and ethnic diversity of a state like California, nor do they reflect the economic diversity. 50% of medical students come from the upper 20th percentile of income. So I think in many ways they often cannot relate to the ills of an individual in a poorer community. So what we've done, again, is really changed how we, the criteria we use to accept students into medical school. And that's resulted in a lot more students really being inspired to do primary care despite the problems that Elizabeth and you have already brought up.
I guess the issues of Medi-Cal reimbursement rates, that's a larger problem, really a political problem. But how does that affect your students and your ability to encourage a diverse group of people to go into primary care?
Well, it's interesting. Our students, almost a third, over the past decade, about a third of our students are from underrepresented in, groups. And they've actually been quite fierce advocates for our health system at UC Davis to maintain their commitment to the Medi-Cal population. I think that's because many of them come from families that were served by Medi-Cal. And if you, again, realize how hard it is to be to have difficulty accessing care because your insurance is the federal insurance, Obamacare, which is in this state, essentially it's Medi-Cal. If you've experienced that difficulty, that hardship, I think you have a very different understanding of what, you know, how important it is that we are inclusive of the Medi-Cal population and that we try to serve all patients to the extent that we can. So our health system has made a real commitment to that, but I don't want to diminish the challenge of it. I agree with you. The state has to make an effort to try to improve those rates. It's a really a complex problem. But I think, again, physicians, when they're young and growing up to be physicians, have to really, it's a long game. It's a really a marathon type of career. And so, like Dr. Dolly, he has a deep commitment to his community. And that's what I think we really need to be focused on in terms of how we choose the next generation of physicians.
That's Dr. Mark Henderson with the UC Davis School of Medicine. Elizabeth Aguilera, final thoughts here. Your piece in Cal Matters examined the doctor shortage, and Dr. Dolly in the Central Valley was the primary character because this is a physician that's in his 70s, right? And he really would like to retire, but he can't leave his community behind because there's really no other primary care doctor to step in. He is working on finding a replacement, though, right? What's the status of that?
Right, he is. So he's 71, and he is definitely hoping to retire soon. He's got plans to travel, and rock hunt is one of his things he loves to do. He has put off his retirement several times, and he now has his eye, their whole community actually has their eye, on a couple at UC Davis who are training residents there who hopefully, they're hoping, will come to Northern California to their community and practice. The wife is from the area, so they're hoping that that's going to be enough to get them to come out. And the local hospital, which closed its obstetrics unit a couple of years ago, they're also pressing the hospital to reopen that because the wife is training in that area. And they're hoping that that will help bring people getting their medical needs taken care of. One thing I did want to mention was, and I'm working on this as a solution, you know, what are the things that the state is doing? And the state and all of these organizations, including UC Davis, are trying to get ahead of this. So just a couple of those things in my story will be coming in a couple of weeks is, you know, loan reimbursement programs, because, of course, if that's something that weighs heavy on you as a medical student, that could be something that could help you.
So you can have more freedom with where you choose to put your specialty, right?
Exactly. Where you choose your specialty, or also if you are a primary care doctor when you graduate, instead of going to an area where you may only get private insurance, you have more freedom to go where the low-income Medi-Cal population is and serve the community that way.
That's Elizabeth Aguilera. We'll be looking out for your piece coming soon about solutions to the doctor shortage. In the meantime, please check out her story in Cal Matters called Paging More Doctors, California's Worsening Physician Shortage. Also on the line with us was Dr. Mark Henderson, professor of internal medicine and vice chair for education and associate dean for admissions at the UC Davis School of Medicine. Dr. Henderson and Elizabeth, thanks so much for being on Air Talk. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle. We're going to talk about the effects of climate change coming up and an effect that you may not have considered. to what goes into your wine glass at night when you might be relaxing on the couch. We'll talk about that coming up after the short break. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Libby Denkman here for Larry Mantle. He's just taking one more day to recover from that summer bug. Well, many people talk about climate change and the effects on glacial melt, sea level rise, or the severity of wildfire seasons. But what about how it will affect what's in your glass at the dinner table? A story in the San Francisco Chronicle takes a look. It's called The End of Cabernet in Napa Valley, and it's about the challenges wineries face to maintain their signature crop while the conditions that Napa grapes make them so successful, those conditions are really changing and making it harder to grow the type of grape that leads to Cabernet. So we want to welcome Esther Mobley, a wine critic at the San Francisco Chronicle, who writes primarily about California wines. And she wrote that story about the impact of climate change on Napa Valley's signature flavor. Esther, thanks very much for being on Air Talk. I think that this is an understood effect of climate change on agriculture and industry in California. So I thank you for writing the piece and for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Libby.
So, Esther Mobley, when you first started looking into this, what are the major challenges that rising temperatures and a changing climate are posing to winemakers?
So I think anyone who's been following the news over the last few years has probably seen firsthand some of the effects that climate change is already having on wine. Drought has been a huge stress over the last several years on all agriculture in California, including wine grapes. Of course, wildfires are affecting wine regions throughout California. But rising temperatures present a whole range of really complicated issues for wine grapes. Different wine grape varieties really have fairly specific temperature bands in which they can thrive and produce great wine. So Cabernet Sauvignon is a grape that is almost synonymous with Napa Valley. It's really what the valley is known for. The entire county's economy kind of runs on Cabernet Sauvignon. And it's a grape that can certainly take a good amount of heat. It's not what we'd call a cool climate grape variety, like something like Pinot Noir or Riesling, which really demand being in cooler climates. But still, like any wine grape, there's a kind of upper heat limit where Cabernet Sauvignon will no longer be able to produce probably a really, really world-class wine. And a lot of wineries are starting to confront the immediate reality of that. I spoke to some wineries who believe that their threshold where they're going to become too hot for really the kind of world-class, high-quality cab they grow now might come as soon as the 2030s.
Wow. So, I mean, in the next couple decades is what you're saying, or in the next decade. That's such a short timeline. And that must mean that folks are having to really reckon with what that'll mean for their businesses, right? What are you seeing winemakers doing in Napa to address this?
What I wrote about this weekend was three pretty high-profile growers in Napa Valley who are kind of frustrated by the lack of industry-wide action taking place in California to address this issue and are taking it upon themselves to plant experimental vineyards. So in the cases of two of the wineries I wrote about, Larkmead Vineyards and Spotswood Winery in Napa Valley, they're actually planting vineyards with grapes that are known to thrive in hot climates, specifically areas around the Mediterranean, Portugal, Italy, Spain. So they're saying, okay, if it's going to really be too hot in a couple of decades to grow the kind of Cabernet that our business depends on right now, are there grapes that thrive in regions like Rioja or inland Portugal that we might be able to plant and might be a kind of shore for our business into the next generation?
I read your piece in the San Francisco Chronicle and was really blown away by the precision of those climate bands that you mentioned and then also what the rising temperatures and you know, faster ripening does to a grape. Can you just briefly describe how different it is for a grape that is ripening in a faster or a hotter summer, and why that affects Cabernet grapes so much?
So ripeness on some level is a matter of sugar accumulation, right? You wait till a fruit, such as a grape, accumulates enough sugar, then you pick it, and that's the central mechanism of wine, is the conversion, the fermentation of that sugar into alcohol. But it's not just about sugar when you're talking about making a fine wine. You also want other compounds in the grape to develop and mature, to produce texture, flavor, and what happens is if the growing season starts off really early, so that's triggered by a warm winter, a dry winter, if the plant starts sprouting its little buds earlier in winter, and then if the summer's really hot and the harvest begins, let's say, in early August or even late July, which we saw in a really hot drought year like 2015, the sugar might have reached a point where you really have to pick the grapes. They've kind of maxed out on their sugar, but the rest of the flavors will be completely underdeveloped. So you might have a grape that's fully sugar ripe, but which still tastes like a bright green jalapeno or bell pepper when you bite into it. The way one winemaker who I interviewed, Dan Petrosky of Larkmead Vineyards, put it when I spoke to him was, you could have a grape that's like a steak, seared on the outside but completely raw on the inside. And that does not sound very appetizing to me.
It does not. Esther Mobley with the San Francisco Chronicle. She's a wine critic, and she wrote a really great piece looking at the effects of climate change on especially Cabernet grapes, which are the cornerstone of the wine industry in Napa Valley. Greg Jones is also on the line with us, director of the Evanstad Center for Wine Education at Linfield College in Oregon. He's also a professor and research climatologist in the Department of Environmental Studies. He focuses on climate variability and how it impacts wine production and quality. Thank you so much for being on the show with us, Mr. Jones. And what do you make of what Napa Valley winemakers are doing to address climate change? And how does that compare to what you're seeing worldwide?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on, and definitely appreciate the article in the Chronicle. You know, I've been studying this overall issue for about 30 years, looking at kind of trying to better understand the role climate plays in deciding how and where varieties can be grown worldwide. And what Napa is experiencing is something that is happening all over the world. The idea that we've become settled into growing a specific variety in specific regions to produce the wines we make is definitely something that we have been trying to address, because climates have always changed, and so you always have to be kind of adaptable within agriculture. But the rate and magnitude of climate change today is so much higher that growers and producers are having to reckon with this issue much more rapidly than they would have otherwise.
And so you're seeing in Napa, they're doing experimental plantings of more drought-resistant varietals. Mm-hmm. What are you seeing in other parts of the world? I understand, you know, you travel in Europe and also New Zealand. I don't know if you also go to South Africa or other places where they have, you know, Chile, a big wine industry. What are you seeing?
Well, I mean, I think it goes back to something that a lot of people might not know, but there are somewhere, you know, 5,000 plus different varieties of Vitis vinifera that people can make into a wine. Yet globally, we plant and harvest and produce, market these as really maybe 18 to 20 different varieties. The diversity that's out there in the wine grape arena is so underutilized. And so what people are doing today is they're saying, okay, we have these varieties that do very well in warm, hot climates. Can we better understand how they can do in my climate? or can we better understand maybe how that can be used in both breeding and genetics to understand or give the variety and the grower the ability to adapt to those individual conditions. So this is going on everywhere. There's been, you know, research in different places that have looked at how can you produce a better rootstock to deal with more drought conditions? How can you, you know, utilize heat tolerance in some varieties versus others? Bordeaux just recently approved the experimentation of 7 new varieties, mostly to deal with the issue of climate change in the future. Now, you know, they need to do this in terms of their legal ramifications, because they put controls on what they can grow relative to what they can market in that product. But here in the United States, I would say what the people in Napa are doing with an experimental vineyard is what they should be doing. You should be doing this all the time. It's just that in this rapid change in climate that we've been experiencing, we need to better understand it sooner rather than later.
That's Greg Jones, director of the Evanstad Center for Wine Education at Linfield College in Oregon. Also with us is Esther Mobley, the author of a wonderful piece looking at the way the wine industry in Napa Valley is responding to the threat of global warming and climate change. Esther, is there a sense from farmers in Napa that they're behind the ball on this, or are some saying it's really not going to be a problem?
Well, there's a lot of people I've spoken to who deny that it's a problem, not to imply that they deny climate change, but I interview one grower for my piece who's not taking the looking at alternative varieties route, but is, as Greg just alluded to, looking at can we adapt the Cabernet plant somehow to withstand heat and drought and erratic weather events, or can we use different rootstocks, different clones, other kinds of technologies in the vineyards. So there's a lot of folks who are saying, hey, we can make Cabernet work. It's just a matter of adapting. I'll say, though, that they also have a real, you know, these are people whose businesses right now are really strongly, enormously built around Cabernet. So as Greg, I think Greg's exactly right. There's a world of great varieties, but somehow the way our wine culture has evolved is we like to identify certain grapes with certain regions. And I think one very likely, and I'm hopeful that this will become an outcome of thinking about climate change, is maybe imagining a little more flexibility about what we think of as an appropriate grape to grow in different places like Napa.
Esther Mobley, a wine critic at the San Francisco Chronicle, and Greg Jones, director of the Evanstad Center at Linfield College in Oregon. Thanks to both of you for joining this conversation. It's fascinating to look at how an industry will have to change and evolve and really experiment to respond to what's occurring in our climate. Thanks again for being part of the segment. Libby Dankman in for Larry Mantle today on Air Talk. We're going to take a short news break, and then we're going to continue on this food and wine kick, because we're going to be talking about ethnic grocery stores in Los Angeles. We have such a diverse food scene in Southern California, and I know you probably have a local ethnic grocery store that you love to go to. Give us a call, 866-893-5722. We're going to be taking your tips coming up after this news break with Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Welcome back to Air Talk, 89.3 KPCC. Libby Dankman here for Larry Mantle. We're hoping Larry's back tomorrow, just getting over a little summer bug. Well, we're talking about the variety of food and dining in Los Angeles, and particularly grocery shopping, because that really is the underpinnings of all kinds of culinary experimentation and innovation in L.A. And last week in the L.A. Times, Jamie Feldmar published an ode to the Armenian-owned international grocery store chain called Super King. And if you haven't been, Super King has 8 locations in L.A. and Orange counties. There's a branch I just discovered not far from my house over on San Fernando Road in Glissell Park. And Super King stores are known for these great deals, their ability to really cater to their neighborhood where they're based. So Jamie's story in the LA Times got us thinking about ethnic markets as a whole around Los Angeles. And we want to get your thoughts. Do you shop at an ethnic grocery store in your neighborhood? Why do you love it? What do you buy there? What are the specialties that you just love to pick up when you go to your local ethnic grocery store? Give us a call at 866-893-5722. Again, 866-893-5722 is the phone number to weigh in. And we have a couple guests in the studio to break this down for us. First, Quincy Sura-Smith is digital assistant producer for KPCC's in-person team. And he also writes a lot about food and culture for LAist.com. And Quincy's working on a piece about Thai markets right now for LAist.com. Hey, Quincy, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, always glad to be on.
So what are you looking at when you are delving into the world of Thai markets in Los Angeles? What are some of the top names that people should know and items in those markets that are really great to pick up?
Well, I think a lot of folks have access to like Asian grocery stores, like the big ones like 99 Ranch, or some might know it as Ranch 99. But sometimes they don't have the very specific things, right? The variety in the specific things. When you talk about curry paste, soy sauces, fish sauces, palm sugar is one major ingredient I definitely want to include in that piece I'm working on. Palm sugar is the specific kind of sweetness you'll get in a dish like pad thai when you make pad thai from scratch. Tamarind paste, when you can get these actual ingredients, the difference between holy basil and Thai basil, both are kinds of basils that Thai folks use when cooking. These are the kinds of things that you can find at a Thai grocery store like Banglak Market, Siloam Supermarket, Bangkok Market, which is actually one of the seeds of Thai Town, which was founded in 1971, or even what is affectionately nicknamed as Thai Costco Laksi, which is this giant warehouse of a market that's just north of downtown, just northeast of Chinatown.
I have to go to Thai Costco now. I didn't even know about this. Nodding her head and smiling along over here, Esther Sang is with us as well. She's a freelance food writer who's writing has appeared in various publications. You know her byline in the LA Times, LAist, Food and Wine, and more. And if you want to follow her, she tweets at E-S-T-A-R-L-A. Esther, thanks for being on Air Talk. And when you hear Quincy talk about Thai Costco, what other markets do you love around Los Angeles that come to mind? Not just Asian markets, all kinds of markets.
Yeah, I love Super King. I'm not Armenian, and I would totally go there for just things that have a really good price point. Maybe leaning a little bit towards bulk. Their cheese, their refrigerator case for cheese is just amazingly cheap. I mean, you get like these huge quantities because you can't not because of that price point. So
the bins of like sunflower seeds, yes, or Persian cucumbers, you just want to dive into them because they're
exactly. So
cheap and they're so plentiful.
Exactly. Yeah, I love Super King. I go to 99 Ranch myself. I put the 99 first myself, and I get frozen pot stickers there. It's even my general convenience Asian supermarket. So, yeah.
And is that, do you go to like locations in the San Gabriel Valley, or is mm-hmm. that something you can find all over the place?
Well, I'm fairly close to the San Gabriel Valley, so it's not too much of a drive. I'll go at it's only like 10 minutes, 12 minutes. So that's totally worth it. I'll stock up.
And why go to 99 Ranch versus, Vaughn's or Ralph's? Like, what are the key finds at 99 Ranch that you feel you just can't get at a mainstream American grocery store?
Right. You'll find, the Asian Latin aisle probably take up about half that length. In the Vaughn's, 99 Ranch is basically Disneyland, whether you want just snacks, snacks that bring you back to being in front of the TV, being this Asian kid, eating dried squid, which is something that's in my memory. So snacks like that, like lychee, different produce, bitter melon, for weirdos, you know. I love all that.
Some shade thrown at the Bitter Melon fans. Itzy, who is a producer on our staff, says her fave is Vallarta for Latin American food, agua frescas, fresh salsa, super cheap produce, and more. And we have some calls coming in. Your favorite ethnic grocery store market around Los Angeles, Southern California, where do you go for great deals and why? Chelsea in North Hollywood. Hey, Chelsea, what do you want to add to the conversation about ethnic grocery stores?
Growing up, I would go to the Plowboys Market and Hawaiian Gardens with my mom and my grandma after church. And it was basically like the farmer's market put indoors. There was sawdust on the floor, every type of produce you could think of. I know they had like dry goods and, you know, boxed cereals and stuff, but I literally only remember the produce and just seeing every type that you could ever think of. And also it's like where I learned that produce isn't all perfect. There's like squishy things and there's things that get overripe. And you could really sort of see the process of them putting things on the floor and like learning about where does our food actually come from.
So Plowboys, it was T-L-O-W Boys, and it's gone now. What's your go-to, you know, since it closed down?
I go to the farmer's market and I go to Trader Joe's and I go to Super King and I go to Ranch 99. I probably go to a different one every week just to get different mix of stuff at home.
Yeah. Well, thanks for remembering, you know, a childhood spent at the market in South Long Beach, Plowboys. I'm sure a lot of people are bummed that it closed. But thanks, Chelsea, for sharing that memory. Jonathan in Sherman Oaks is on the line. Jonathan, your go-to ethnic market in L.A.?
Well, in Encino, I absolutely love Domingo's Italian Deli. I've been going since I was a kid. The sandwiches they make there are incredible. And under new ownership a couple of years ago, they started baking their own pizzas and baking their own breads. And it's only gotten better. And it's a great place to get olive oil, pastas. And it's the only place in my neighborhood I can find Botarga, which is a cured fish roe product. And it's a must. But the really special place for me, Libby, is the is Papa Cristo's, or I think they also call it the C&K Import Market. And that's in Pico. That's on Pico Boulevard near Normandy, and it's a Greek place. I'm the fourth generation of my family. My son's the fifth that has shopped there. And starting with my great-grandfather, who went there in the 1950s. And it's a local Greek neighborhood market, and on the weekends the line goes crazy and people get fresh grilled food and all kinds of staples. I go for the cheese. There's cheeses there that I can't get other places. Halloumi and kasseri and, you know, different varieties of feta.
Oh, man, it's getting close to lunchtime, Jonathan. Your shout out to Papa Cristo's has me want to just pop on over there right now. I love that you have a family legacy going there as well. And also Domingo's Italian Deli and Encino. Great suggestions. Great shout outs. Thank you, Jonathan. Colin from Sherman Oaks. Quincy Surasmith with LAist and our KPCC in-person team. Jonathan's shout outs for Papa Cristo's. That's great. Any more kind of that genre? Either Greek or Italian, you know, European ethnic markets that you can think of?
LA is like dotted with so many of these like Italian grocery / deli places, right? That I think were probably much more popular in the early to mid century that are still around East Side, right in like that kind of downtown Chinatown area. I know Giuliano's down in Gardena, of course, Bay Cities, right, which is over in Santa Monica. Granted, I go to a lot of these places for their sandwiches and like food I'm going to eat right then, not food I'm going to like cook a little bit later. But those are just like three of them, right? There's a gajillion all over LA and all over the county area, because I think those are the old mainstays.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I'm loving your encyclopedic knowledge of you know, these markets. Esther saying, I hear you agreeing. You know, when you think about a family shopping at the same place generation after generation, I think that's such a cool legacy. You know, it's just something to pass down because food is so connected to memory.
Absolutely. And I come from a transplant's point of view, so maybe this, you know, hopefully I'm the first generation, you know, to start this kind of thing.
Because you're from Wisconsin, right?
I am.
You did not grow up with this type of variety that Southern California offers. What was that like to first come to LA and realize there's so many options?
Well, at least it was like an hour and a half north of Chicago. But in downtown Milwaukee was our one entire, like, it was our Oriental grocer. you know, and
was it at least run by people from Asia?
Yes.
Okay.
It was. And I mean, because we were the only ones who ever cared about that sort of thing, you know, we got our bok choy there, you know, which you can probably find in a Vons now, you know. So that just says a lot to how, I mean, I came here for these opportunities because they're provided by the different communities in L.A.
Yeah, it's so different. I Seattle, where I come from, is, you know, relatively rich with Asian markets, mm-hmm. And a lot of Vietnamese grocery stores. I grew up really close to an Awajimaya market, which is a grocery chain in the Pacific Northwest, Japanese-American and really great Asian groceries. So I felt like we had great access to that. But then coming to L.A. as a transplant, you're just blown away by the options. And we're getting more calls from people who share their favorite ethnic grocery stores. We're going to take a quick break here. Coming back with more calls, 866-893-5722 to share your favorite ethnic grocery store in Southern California. I'm here with Quincy Sura-Smith with the KPCC in-person team and Esther Sang, a freelance food writer. You'll see her byline in LAist.com, LA Times, Food & Wine, all sorts of places. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. Back after this. Hey there, it's Air Talk. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. We're taking your calls on the favorite ethnic grocery store chains around Southern California. And we have Ken in Pasadena. Hey, Ken, where do you shop and why?
So there's a couple places in San Gabriel. H Mart, which is a huge Korean market. They took an old Vons market and turned it into this huge Korean market. About two-thirds of it is all different type of food items. And then the other third is maybe bakery and a restaurant in there. So we go there. We bring the kids there at least once a week, have a different experience. There's people there cooking food, giving out samples, and you can kind of strike a conversation with these people and have an understanding of how they cooked it. And it's just a real nice experience, different than obviously going to a Ralph's or a Whole Foods even.
Yeah, that talking to people and striking up a conversation about the ingredients and things like that, I think that's such a great point that you bring up. Ken in Pasadena, thanks for your call. 866-893-5722 to raise a toast to your favorite Asian or Latino or various ethnic grocery stores around Los Angeles. We have James in Covina calling in. And James, you are talking about Middle Eastern food. Where do you shop?
So Covina, off of Sunflower and Arrow Highway, there's a store called Bashar Market. It's been there for at least 25 years. We used to go when I was a kid. And now I go with my wife and kids there. It was the only place growing up in Covina to really get Middle Eastern spices and foods. And it's amazingly still there. It's changed owners, I think, once or twice. But it's still Middle Eastern and really South Asian market, Indian spices and stuff. Bashar Market, it's wonderful. It's always clean. The owners are very nice. We know them. Not personally or anything, but we still go there for 25 plus years now that we've been in the U.S. and it's still there, and we're really happy that it is.
It must feel good, too, to be supporting a small business. You know, the fact that you know who the owners are, you're watching this up close, and you can kind of, you know, have a family legacy with it, as we've mentioned before. James, what are the ingredients that you really like to pick up at Bashar Market, or the foods that you like to pick up?
Well, you mentioned Super King, and before Super King, that's the only place we could get Persian cucumbers was Bashar Market in Covina. So we like our cucumbers. We like the turmeric and the special parsley that we have for our foods, the dill pickles, the dill stuff that we get. It's really, I can't name them all in English, honestly, but just certain spices that we know. And honestly, even 20 plus years ago, there was no real need for a label on those spices. We just knew that that's the spice we wanted, and they always had it, and they still do. I mean, they've gotten better at labeling things now, but we know them, and we there's other options now, but honestly, having that 20-plus year relationship with the store, Bashar Market is just, that's where we go every week still, and I was telling your screener, I live in Rancho Cucamonga now, and we still drive back to Covina at least once a week to them and others in the area that we grew up with.
Yeah, so you're really committed. That's a bit of a drive. James and Covina, thanks very much for calling in and giving this shout out to Bashar Market for Middle Eastern food. What do you think, Quincy, is the hallmark of a great ethnic market? What makes it so good, and what makes people coming back?
You know, sometimes I really think about, we're really lucky right now to have all these like big chains, right, that come from all these different communities, right? Like you have 99 Ranch and 168 Market. You have H Mart mentioned earlier, Xi'an Market. These are Korean markets. You have Mitsuwa Marukai and Nijiya, the trio of Japanese American supermarkets. But I miss all these like small markets, that some of which still exist, right, that they split their kitchen so that it's a restaurant and like three shelves of groceries, right? I used to live on the West Side, and I would go to Jasmine Market, which was Burmese and Indian food, as well as like three shelves. I used to live right on the block with Simpang Asia, which is an Indonesian market, which and a little restaurant that they got so successful, they bought the shop next to them, and so now they have a whole dedicated grocery part and a restaurant part. And I remember these times when I couldn't get out to a big 99 Ranch or to a Thai specific market in like East Hollywood or North Hollywood, I would go to these other markets. I think that's so much of this thing where that's beautiful about Southern California is you can go to a culture specific grocery store other than your own cultures, because it's like you can still get some really great stuff, some great produce, meat, spices that you still can't find.
Yeah. Penny in Hacienda Heights is writing in Orange County. She says has some incredible finds. Wholesome Market in Irvine has the best Indian and Mediterranean food. And the Moscow Deli is an amazing Russian grocery store in Costa Mesa. Esther Sang, when you are looking for, a hallmark of a great ethnic grocery store, something that will make you come back, what are those things? Like I heard, I think, James say that the conversations are one of them, being able to strike up a conversation about ingredients.
Yeah.
What else are you really looking for to make a great market?
You know, sometimes I'll ask the Asian ladies for help with my recipe. They are a wealth of knowledge, and they love helping you, just like bar none. They love helping you. And that's like the personal interaction that you get at a grocery store that you wouldn't get. Or I don't want to say you would definitely not get it, but, you know, it's just more likely to happen. You share this culture.
So
or
if
you're
you come across like an ingredient and you can find the nearest grandma and just be like, what do I do?
Exactly.
What do I do with this?
She'll go on for 20 minutes about it.
Yeah. Kristen in West L.A. is on the line. Hey, Kristen, what did you want to say?
Hi there. So I live in West Los Angeles in the Sawtell neighborhood, and my family is Caucasian, but my children who have been raised in this neighborhood absolutely have embraced Japanese culture by shopping at the markets on Sawtell, by going to the restaurants. My oldest daughter is learning to speak and write in Japanese. And I don't think if we lived somewhere else, we would have been as entrenched in the culture. Lots of people go to Little Tokyo downtown, but if you haven't come over to the Sawtell area, it is fantastic. And it is like the nightlife is amazing. It has influenced how I shop, how I cook, and there are plenty of Japanese markets in this area.
Yeah, Kristen in West LA, thanks so much. Yeah, shout out to Sawtell and the history of Japanese businesses there. Of course, we can't end this segment without mentioning Roma Market here in Pasadena, owned and operated by native Sicilian. It has a ton of imported pasta, wine, sauce, all that good stuff, and it's famous for the sandwich. So shout out to Roma Market. And thank you so much to my guests today, Esther Sang, who writes for all sorts of food outlets, LA Times, LAist, Food and Wine. She tweets at ESTARLA. And Quincy Surasmith, a digital assistant producer for the KBCC in-person team. He tweets at Quintessence. Did I get that right, Quincy?
Yeah, you sure did.
So follow Quintessence on Twitter. And thanks to all of you who called in to share your favorite ethnic grocery stores in Los Angeles. Libby Denkman here for Larry Mantle. So nice to be with you. And I'm hoping Larry is back tomorrow feeling better. Fresh Air is next.